The headlines: Iran's lead delegate in Vienna talks, says that Tehran will implement the 2015 nuclear deal once the U.S. removes all sanctions mentioned in the accord or imposed after its JCPOA withdrawn. Russia expels 7 European diplomats in a tit-for-tat move amid its recent diplomatic tensions with the Czech Republic. And also in our headlines, a court in Brussels begins the European Commission's legal proceedings against drug maker AstraZeneca over vaccine supplies. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Iran says there are still major differences with the U.S. on who should come back to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal first. After meeting with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal in Vienna, Iran's lead delegate says there are still big challenges ahead. Kamal Ezgi reports from the Austrian capital.
Following another meeting with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal in Vienna, Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says there are still big challenges ahead as diplomatic attempts continue to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. The main problem is still who should come back first, Iran or the U.S.
The problem or the challenge is about the sequence of who should come first, who should come first to full compliance and full implementation of its commitments. On that, obviously, there are still differences. Our position is quite clear, and we are not going to change that.
Russia and China support Iran's demand that the U.S. remove sanctions in a verifiable manner first.
We believe it is the U.S. previous administration who first pulled out from the JCPOA. So it's just axiomatic that U.S. should abolish all its unilateral sanctions against Iran, as well as any third party in the first place, before Iran moved to implement the provisions on the JCPOA accordingly. So this is a fundamental issue involving rights versus wrong.
There are also serious differences on which sanctions the U.S. should remove.
Our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA, and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration.
Up until now, two working groups have been trying to come up with a final list of U.S. sanctions that need removing and nuclear measures that need to be taken by Iran. From Wednesday, a third working group will begin discussions on timetables and sequence, as well as ways to verify sanctions lifting. Homad Ezgi, Vienna.
Iran's president says the Israeli regime was behind last year's assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in Iraq.
The martyrdom of General Soleimani was the handiwork of Zionists. It is right that the one who ordered his assassination was Trump, but it was Israel which was behind it all and provoked Washington to kill a senior general who sacrificed his life to serve the interests of the region.
President Rouhani said General Soleimani was fighting Daesh when the terrorist group posed a threat to holy sites in Iraq as well as the capital, Baghdad. Elsewhere in his remarks, the president said the U.S., Israel, and some reactionary states in the region hatched plots against Iran to deal a blow to the country, but to no avail. A prominent Lebanese composer has reportedly been arrested by Saudi authorities upon arrival in the kingdom. Reports say Samir Safar was in Saudi Arabia at the invitation of a Saudi Information Ministry official. The Lebanese Foreign Ministry has contacted the Saudi embassy in Beirut over the issue. But Saudi authorities have refused to respond to the request for information. Saudi authorities have also refused to allow Safir's wife to meet him. Other reports say Safir was arrested a week ago after his residence was raided by Saudi security officials. They say he was then taken to a prison in the country's west. Safir is a vocal supporter of Lebanese President Michel Aoun and has voiced support for Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. Our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Salih, says Saudi Arabia is using whatever it can as leverage to pursue its anti-Hezbollah policies.
Well, the latest that we do know about what his situation is, we know from the Lebanese ambassador in Saudi Arabia, who has told media that he he was informed by the Saudi intelligence that Sfair is only being held for interrogation, that he is there as a witness, and that he's not being arrested for any sort of crime. This is what he was told, but we don't have any other details. And like you said, his wife has not been able to contact him, so we don't know anything about his situation. We all know that he only went with an invitation by the Saudis. At the same time, you have closer ties between Saudi Arabia and Israel, so this has led to even more animosity, if we may say, against Lebanon from the Saudis, despite the fact that all Lebanese politicians always express that they want to keep brotherly ties with the Saudi kingdom. So there are the fact that the Saudi kingdom is only using anything that it can politically against Lebanon, and namely what they want to see is that Hezbollah is isolated, Hezbollah is not part of a political process, that Hezbollah is not even given or allowed to remain a group that is supported and expressing a huge portion of the Lebanese people.
In Tehran, government officials have gathered to celebrate the National Persian Gulf Day. The occasion marks the anniversary of the expulsion of Portuguese military forces from the waterway centuries ago. It's celebrated every year in response to efforts by some countries to change the name of the waterway. Yusuf Jalali reports.
The Persian Gulf is Iran's eternal home. This is the theme of this gathering in Tehran, where top officials sat together to celebrate the Persian Gulf Day. The occasion marks the anniversary of the expulsion of Portuguese military forces from the Strait of Hormuz back in 1622 by Iranian forces. The move to designate such a day on the Iranian calendar came in 2004 in response to a wave of efforts by some of Iran's Arab neighbors to change the name of the waterway to the Arabian Gulf. Observers believe there are political and economic drives behind such attempts.
Due to its role as a hub for 65% of the world's energy transit, the Persian Gulf has for decades been exposed to attempts by some countries to bring it under their control. To this end, some Arab states have tried to use forged names for the waterway, but the entire world and history have always referred to it as the Persian Gulf.
There are 6,000 historical maps that show that the term Persian Gulf has been used in different languages since 400 BC. In 2006, the United Nations officially recognized the Persian Gulf as the historical and international name of the body of water. Addressing the ceremony, Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf said along with efforts to change the name of the strategic waterway, there are also attempts by extraterritorial forces to undermine the security of the Persian Gulf.
Foreign forces are present in the Persian Gulf under the excuse of security, but they have created nothing but troubles and threats. The security of the region can only be ensured by the regional countries, and extra-regional forces only weaken the security here. I hope that one day we would celebrate the Persian Gulf Day with greater joy and happiness by expelling all the troublesome foreign forces from the Persian Gulf.
The Persian Gulf stretches for some 250,000 square kilometers. Half of this vast expanse belongs to Iran, and the rest is shared by seven littoral countries. This has earned Iran the responsibility to secure the waterway and the strategic Strait of Hormuz, which hosts one-fifth of the world's oil shipment.
The Persian Gulf is of global significance, both geopolitically and economically. So the question of why there are efforts to change its name is not hard to answer. But to Iranians, the waterway is more than just an economic source, but a symbol of national identity and the legacy from the country's ancient civilization. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Russia has expelled seven European diplomats for what it called false solidarity with the Czech Republic. Russia's foreign minister ordered the expulsion of four diplomats from Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and three others from Slovakia. The move came after these Baltic states expelled Russian diplomats following Prague's allegations over Moscow's potential role in a deadly warehouse blast in 2014 in the Czech Republic. However, Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš has expressed doubt about the alleged Russian involvement in the explosion. Moscow also strongly denies the claims in a series of tit-for-tat measures. The two countries have expelled a series of each other's diplomats and embassy staff. Well, the UK's Electoral Commission has launched a formal probe into the financing of the refurbishment of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Downing Street apartment. The commission, which regulates party and election finances said there were reasonable grounds to suspect an offense or offenses may have been committed. Johnson has been accused by his former aide, Dominic Cummings, of seeking to use potentially illegal donations to renovate his residence. Nonetheless, the premier has denied breaking the rules. He has also rejected reports that he said he would rather see bodies piled high in their thousands than order a third coronavirus lockdown. The opposition has demanded Johnson's resignation if the reports come to be true. The European Commission has begun legal proceedings against Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca over its vaccine supplies. The Commission said the proceedings have begun at the Brussels Court of First Instance. The Commission accuses AstraZeneca of failing to fulfill its contract for the supply of COVID-19 vaccines. The company is also accused of not having a reliable plan to ensure timely deliveries. The Commission says the proceedings could be concluded in a matter of weeks. AstraZeneca says any litigation is without merit. Under an advance purchase deal, AstraZeneca had agreed to deliver 180 million cases, doses that is of vaccines, to the EU in the second quarter of 2021. However, the company said last month that it would deliver only one-third of the agreed jabs. India posts yet another double record of coronavirus infections and deaths amid severe shortages of oxygen, medical supplies, and hospital staff. The health ministry has registered nearly 361,000 new cases. That's the largest single-day total in the world. Some 3,300 people also died of the virus in the past 24 hours as India's total fatalities surpassed the 200,000 mark. This is while experts believe the official tally vastly underestimates the actual toll in the world's second most populous country. Neighboring Pakistan has also registered a new record of fatalities with over 200 additional deaths. The country's death toll is now past 17.5 thousand. The government is planning to impose stricter lockdowns to fight the surge. Munawar Zaman says the current coronavirus situation in India is nothing but utter mayhem.
It is absolutely chaos. What I'm talking about now, the oxygen supply and beds only. The medical teams are completely exhausted. We don't have manpower. We don't have such manpower in this country who can handle a crisis-like situation. I mean, it's unprecedented. The oxygen supplies and beds are something which was already there since last week. Now, what the country is dealing with is a manpower shortage. They're running short of people to handle such crisis. And every single day, what we see, the figures are climbing. And many experts have I've spoken with, they say it's just a glimpse of the actual figures if we consider the population of the country. In many parts of the country, you don't even have the data. The data is not available. There are mass cremations happening in many parts of the country. Here in New Delhi, which is the capital city of the country, we witness mass cremations in many places. And even there's a lot of fluctuation between what the government data gives you and what the actual figures are, because figures are not being registered. One more thing I would like to add up is now there is an urgent need for this country for an international support, which is pouring in, but it is pouring in very slowly. The international support needs to pour in very fast and very proactively.
Brazil's Senate has launched an inquiry into the government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, promising an impartial investigation.
Não foi por acaso.
It was not by chance of the divine scourge that brought us to this situation. There are those responsible, of course. There are responsible for action or omission, negligence or incompetence, and they, if proven, will be held accountable.
The focus of the inquiry will be on the missteps of President Jair Bolsonaro's government, including downplaying the pandemic and promoting ineffective treatments, the delays in securing vaccines, as well as the removal of three health ministers during the pandemic are among the issues to be investigated. The country has reported more than 72,000 new cases and over 3,000 deaths in the past 24 hours. Brazil is the world's second hardest hit country in terms of deaths, with more than 395,000 fatalities. The United States military has finally begun a total retreat from Afghanistan after two decades of failure. The invasion's impact on American culture and on the average American has already been devastating, and its consequences will be felt for the years to come. Rami Mazardi reports from Chicago.
Twice as long as Vietnam, but perhaps exponentially more disastrous, the United States invasion of Afghanistan has mercifully reached a final conclusion. The U.S. military just announced it has begun a total withdrawal. and there's unanimous agreement that America's longest war was a complete failure. Aiming to eradicate terrorism, the war only caused terrorism to proliferate. Groups like ISIL and Al-Qaeda infested huge swaths of territory from Mali to Iraq. Begun in 2001, not even a month after the 9/11 attacks, on the pretext of eradicating the Taliban, the United States leaves without even enough leverage to get the Taliban to the negotiating table. While new U.S. President Joe Biden said the retreat would be finished by September 11th, the Taliban threatened major reprisals if the U.S. stays past the May 1st deadline negotiated by Donald Trump. American commentators usually refer to the domestic impact of the war with the cynical phrase, blood and treasure. But the invasion of Afghanistan led to the freedom-stripping Patriot Act, institutionalized Islamophobia, and the prolonged war hysteria of the George W. Bush era. Barack Obama contributed illegal drone attacks, a surge of even more troops, and keeping Guantanamo Bay open even after winning a Nobel Peace Prize. The repeatedly shocking Donald Trump came to power in large part due to his promise to avoid starting more domestically devastating foreign wars like in Afghanistan. Over 2,000 Americans died in combat, but nearly 800,000 U.S. soldiers served in Afghanistan. Not only are they bringing home physical and psychological trauma, but perhaps often a highly militarized view of global politics and the Muslim world. The war on terror may be concluding, but its legacy is immense destruction at home and across the Muslim world. The United States will now shift many of their troops to counter an alleged threat from China and Russia. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. Plead to God. The second point is that all kinds of requests, even small ones, can and should be made to God during these prayers, supplications and dhikrs. However, you should not confine your requests to minor needs. There are greater needs and requests which should not be forgotten. The greatest request is divine forgiveness. You should ask God to remove signs of sin and violation from your hearts and souls. You should ask God to smooth the path of repentance for you. Another great request is divine kindness. You should ask Allah the Exalted to bestow His kindness on you. Another great request is correcting the affairs of the Islamic Ummah. You should ask Allah the Exalted to correct the affairs of all Muslims, not only the people of Iran and all Islamic countries. You should ask Him to guide humanity towards the straight path. These prayers have a good chance of being answered. They are the ones which are answered. They open the path and prepare the ground. They help us to reach great goals.
رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 يا حبيب رمضان ليتك دوما قريب
Returning to God. To feel guilty, there is no need to commit sins for years. No, even a single sin counts. Sins must not be underestimated. In a hadith about underestimating sins, it is narrated that underestimation of sins is disapproved. The reason for this is that God has said, "We will forgive." For this reason, repentance and returning to God is very important. Not that committing a sin is unimportant or trivial. On the contrary, it is very dangerous. But returning to God, paying attention to God and dhikr are so important that if done honestly and correctly, then that incurable diseases will be cured. Multidimensional blessings. Dua brings one closer to God. It makes knowledge effective and permanent in the heart. It strengthens faith, and this is all besides what is asked for in the dua, which is a supplication to God and is, God willing, fulfilled. So, dua has multidimensional blessings. That is why the Holy Quran repeatedly speaks about dua and supplications by pious servants of God. This is all a lesson for us.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
respond.
The deadly and highly contagious novel coronavirus has had a huge impact on billions of people's lives, weighing down on the economy, putting workers out of work around the globe, and more. After gaining an understanding of the virus, countries around the world began developing their versions of a COVID-19 vaccine.
It's called Operation Warp Speed. That means big and it means fast. A massive scientific, industrial, and logistical endeavor unlike anything our country has seen since the Manhattan Project.
The United States, under former President Donald Trump, launched a vaccine program dubbed Operation Warp Speed and invested heavily in producing, delivering, and distributing the jabs. The program proved successful, and the country produced different vaccines for the disease. But under patent-related restrictions, it prevented other nations from having access to the know-how to produce life-saving vaccines at home. With Donald Trump gone, President Joe Biden is now facing increasing pressure to issue a waiver for the restrictions. Several Democratic leaders, including Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, have joined a petition with 2 million signatures demanding that the U.S. administration drop its support of a World Trade Organization agreement that bars other countries from accessing the patents. Charity organization Oxfam has called the current situation of the distribution of jabs in the world as vaccine apartheid, knowing that the world is dealing with a public health emergency and that the pandemic isn't a private profit opportunity.
The fact that the U.S. does not want to remove a patent on some of its key vaccine developments against COVID-19 is another symbol of how this empire is ruled by profits, by money, by the pursuit of wealth against everything else. It doesn't care about human life. It doesn't care about human beings and their health and prosperity. It cares about money because the United States worships money. Its God is money. And it's something that's horrible to understand because we're in the middle of overcoming a pandemic that is still very much a threat to a lot of people around the world.
The comments come ahead of shareholder meetings for the giant pharmaceutical company. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, peoples in the United States have received approximately a quarter of total vaccines administered around the globe. Other wealthier nations in the world have also received significantly higher numbers of vaccines compared to middle and low-income countries. A Washington Post report indicates the United States will have an oversupply of hundreds of millions of coronavirus vaccine doses as soon as July. The figure has raised concerns about possible hoarding in the country. Earlier this month, Amnesty International condemned richer countries for failing a, quote, rudimentary test of global solidarity by hoarding COVID vaccines, accusing them of exploiting the pandemic to undermine human rights. Also, the World Health Organization warned richer countries that their deals with big pharmaceutical companies will hurt the global COVAX program for poorer nations. The UN agency says its plan to roll out 1.3 billion doses of vaccine to low and middle-income nations by the end of this year has been slow, as wealthier nations are approaching vaccine manufacturers that the COVAX program is counting on.
We can't expect these big countries like the United States, like the United Kingdom, to save us, because they haven't, and we're seeing that happen as we speak. We're seeing these first world developed countries hoard access to medicine and vaccines that can potentially save the lives of millions of people around the world. And the only way we're going to get around this is developing the means of production, developing infrastructure, doing what Iran is doing, what China is doing, what Venezuela and Cuba and Russia and others are doing, and creating pharmaceutical industries that are not dependent on Pfizer, not dependent on Moderna, not dependent on Johnson & Johnson, but are shared technologies by all people around the world.
We're in the middle of a pandemic that has spread to every country in the world. Unless all the Earth's 8 billion inhabitants are vaccinated, the novel coronavirus is expected to stay with us for much longer.
The holy occupied city of Jerusalem al-Quds has seen regular clashes over the past week between Palestinian residents and Israeli military forces who have been blocking Palestinians from sitting on the steps of Damascus Gate. This is while thousands of Palestinians traditionally sit in the area following nighttime prayers during the holy Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. On Thursday, the Israeli regime forces attacked Palestinians who gathered outside of the Damascus Gate on the north side of the occupied old city of Jerusalem al-Quds. That ignited protests against restrictions on their Palestinians' gatherings in Jerusalem al-Quds' old city during the fasting month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians were injured at the Damascus Gate of the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds as Palestinian activists confronted hundreds of far-right and extremist Israeli settlers chanting death to Arabs in their rally in the center of the occupied city. Palestinian protesters, angered by chants of death to Arabs from far-right Jewish demonstrators, clashed repeatedly with Israeli police. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said in a statement that at least 105 Palestinians were injured, including 22 people who were hospitalized. Also, Israeli forces arrested at least 50 Palestinians during the clashes. The Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas denounced the violence against Palestinians, saying that he holds the Israeli regime accountable for this serious deterioration. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has denounced Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds, expressing its solidarity with the victims. Meanwhile, dozens of rockets were fired from the Gaza Strip towards Israel in alliance with protesters in al-Quds. Israeli media said that the Palestinian resistance movement fired 36 rockets toward the occupied territories. Israeli authorities claimed that most of the rockets had struck open areas. Only six of the projectiles had been intercepted by the Iron Dome missile defense system. Israel responded by carrying out airstrikes across the besieged coastal sliver.
I think what's going on is that there has been a continuation of violence, state violence, by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinians, against the indigenous people. And it is the latest chapter, if you like, of what's actually been going on in terms of that. And this idea of the Zionists trying to take over that land, take over that place, is something that is continuing unabated. And it is something that needs to be recognized for what it is that they are actually doing.
Israel lays claim to the entire Jerusalem al-Quds, but the international community views the city's eastern sector as occupied territory, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state. According to the UN Security Council Resolution 478, other member states are prohibited from establishing diplomatic missions in Jerusalem al-Quds. The resolution states that the Council does not recognize Jerusalem al-Quds as the occupying Israeli regime's capital. Palestinians who seek an independent state in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, with East Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital, have condemned the U.S. pro-Israel agenda. During the former U.S. President Donald Trump, Israel stepped up its settlement expansion in defiance of the U.N. Security Council Resolution 2334. According to the resolution, settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds are illegal. Also, several countries, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, normalized their relations with the Israeli regime by signing the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. All of them are illegal under international law, for they were built on occupied land.
Unless there is a reality check and unless there is something done to recognize the oppression that the Israelis are carrying out on that occupied land, nothing is going to change. There is going to be no peace without justice being served.
Israel has made it a priority to change the demographics of Jerusalem al-Quds and Judaize the city slowly but surely. While Palestinians are the rightful owners of Jerusalem al-Quds, and the international community is against the Israeli regime's illegal settlements, there have not been any moves to stop Israel from advancing its plans.
From drones to missiles, Iran's been enhancing its military and defense capabilities by employing and testing homegrown state-of-the-art technologies.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently released footage portraying the country's latest advancements in the field of drone technology. The footage captured by IRGC drones shows close-up shots of an American aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf. The Defense Force also released a video that showed its kamikaze drones hitting their targets with surgical accuracy. Meanwhile, the head of the U.S. Central Command, which oversees the American forces stationed in the West Asia region, revealed to the U.S. Congress that Iranian drone power has stripped the American Air Force of what the commander called its upper hand in the world. General McKenzie made the comments in written testimony to the House Armed Services Committee, in which he noted how Washington was daunted by Iran's far and wide application of small and medium-sized drones for surveillance and attacks. The top general said Iran's ballistic missile force is the most formidable in the region.
This is something that is going to be very troubling to U.S. government officials, because they certainly don't want anybody to have major power except for themselves and some of their allies, such as Israel in the Middle East. But as far as the U.S. finally conceding that its power is limited, it's going to take a long time for them to actually recognize that, to face that reality. They're going to work hard to overcome it, spending more money than they already spend on the military. And right now, the U.S. spends more on its military than the next 10 nations combined. So it's going to be another kind of arms race, and it will not have a good outcome at all. But hopefully the United States will at some point turn its attentions elsewhere into some other area, either of the world or looking more closely at its own internal problems.
Iran's military says the capabilities have enabled it to nip any security threat in the bud.
I am announcing today that we...
Tensions between Iran and the United States escalated after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew Washington from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign, reinstating sanctions against Tehran and ramping up its military presence in the West Asia region. What happened following the move has been regarded as a test of strength for Iran, not only economically, but also militarily. One instance proving Iran's military advancements occurred on June 20, 2019, when Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps shot down an intruding United States RQ-4A Global Hawk spying drone with a surface-to-air missile over the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has repeatedly said its military capabilities are merely for the defensive purposes and has called for regional cooperation to ensure peace in the Persian Gulf region. In this regard, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani presented a plan dubbed the Hormuz Peace Initiative, or HOPE, which aims at establishing long-term peace in the region, an issue that Iran says is impossible as long as outsiders are present.
This will happen eventually. More and more nations will see that they can rely on Iran. Iran has the strength, Iran has the will, and Iran is looking for peace in the Middle East. The United States is not looking for peace in the Middle East. It has no interest in peace in the Middle East, which is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, why the Iranian government will not work with the United States. Iran is a force to be reckoned with, and the United States has just recognized that in a major way.
But what does the U.S. recognition of Iran's military power amid its waning presence in the region mean for Washington? Only time can tell.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it routinely launches airstrikes against targets in Syria. It is also widely blamed for high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran. The regime is believed to have carried out the recent sabotage attack on Iran's Natanz nuclear facility, which operates under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran was quick to pledge to retaliate for the attack on Natanz. Tel Aviv apparently knows no limit when it comes to clandestine operations against other countries. The regime always says it carries out such actions out of worries for its own security. Such dangerous policies could be starting to backfire. This week, a sensitive missile factory in central Israel was rocked by a powerful blast. The huge explosion, which created a mushroom cloud, hit the Tomer factory for advanced weapons. Israeli officials say the blast was a test. On Thursday, a missile fired from Syria landed near the secretive Dimona nuclear weapons facility, triggering warning sirens. The Israeli military said the projectile was a surface-to-air missile fired by Syrian forces against Israeli warplanes. It says the projectile overflew its target and landed near Dimona. But the heavily protected nuclear facility is some 300 kilometers south of Damascus. It is a very long distance for an errant missile. The missile fired from Syria on Thursday landed just some 30 kilometers away from the notorious Israeli nuclear facility. Military experts say this has once again revealed that much trumpeted Israeli air defenses are penetrable. The projectile made it through the air defense layers despite the fact that anti-aircraft and anti-missile systems around Dimona have been significantly boosted in anticipation of a possible retaliatory missile or drone attack by Iran or resistance groups close to Iran.
By looking at this particular site, Dimona, where this weapon nearly hit, it's saying, well, if you really want to have some sort of fight, you do realise that your nuclear facilities, we know exactly where they are, and they could be hit too. And I'm afraid just simply repeating the lies about the impenetrability of the Israeli air defences and missile defences is not going to save anybody in a conflict. It's really just hot air.
Israeli media, like the Times of Israel, have highlighted the fact that the missile landed deep inside Israel amid heightened tensions with Iran and after Tehran's pledge of retaliation. Some other media organizations, like the Middle East Monitor, said Netanyahu's comments after the attack on Natanz looked like a claim of responsibility, and this may have pushed Iran to retaliate. Israel seems increasingly worried about the possibility of the United States removing sanctions against Iran to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal that America abandoned under former President Donald Trump. Israel has always been a vociferous critic of the deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The regime could carry out more covert operations against the Iranians, further raising regional tensions. But if that happens and things spiral out of control, the regime has to be held responsible for possible repercussions for the region and beyond.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We've started talking about the month of Ramadan and how this month is linked to the humanitarian aspect of things. So the month of Ramadan has multi-faceted dimensions. So you could link it to the afterlife, you could link it to spirituality, you could link it to, willpower and a personal development. And also we link it to humanity. So you could look at it from a different aspect. So we're looking at it from the humanitarian aspect. And previously we spoke about hunger. So that's the first thing we get deprived of, food. We're not allowed to eat, so we get hungry. And we said when we get hungry, we have to think of our fellow human beings who are dying on a daily basis because of hunger. The second thing we're not allowed to do is the fact we cannot drink water. And water is essential in the life of a human being. And especially those who don't exercise and fasting throughout the year, like in the recommended fast, and they just fast the month of Ramadan, they will feel the thirst up front because their body is just not used to it. And sometimes statistically that we don't drink enough water as it is, as we should be. So once a person fasts, the first thing he would feel before hunger is thirst. So he will feel thirsty and he needs to drink. Again, there's a message in that. When you get thirsty, think of people who do not have water. And now, let me enlighten you in this regard. When it comes to water, there are millions of people who do not have the ability to drink water. So, the number, according to World Vision, is 785 million people around the world don't have a lack to access to clean drinking water. So, and every day, over 800 children, that's on a daily basis, die from dirty water. So if you multiply that by 365, you end up with 280 something thousand. So 285,000 almost yearly children die because they do not have drinking water. So they just have dirty water. So just due to diarrhea caused by poor water, sanitation or hygiene. So water is not available for them, and there are no facilities and to accommodate for them. So they end up drinking either dirty water or not drinking water at all. So that's a massive number to look at. So 785 million people around the globe do not have access to drinking water. That's a pandemic itself. That's a problem itself. So during the month of Ramadan, when you feel thirst and you feel your throat's getting dry, think of those million of people or millions of people who cannot drink water, who do not have access to water or drinking water. Because sometimes you could drink water, but you could find it, but doesn't mean it is drinkable. You could live next to the sea, but doesn't mean you can drink the sea if you don't have the facilities to filter that water. So water scarcity is a crisis around the globe, where people and millions of people until today, they depend on water from wells. They don't have pipes, they don't have pumps, they don't have nothing. And me and you, in this month, we need to take that seriously as well. Now, let us take a break and we will continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners. And just before the break, we were talking about water and how there are 780 people living without clean drinking water or no water to begin with, which is a massive problem. We have a duty of care towards our fellow human beings. In the same way that there are organizations that take the money and are trying to feed people, there are many organizations that take the money as well and try to create either dig wells or create irrigation system for people to drink from and for people to use and to access. Otherwise, many people in a lot of countries around the world, especially in the sub-Sahara Africa or sub-Africa, you have many people until today, women, they go walk for hours to get water in containers they either carry by their hand or they put on their heads because they don't have vehicles or means to transport water. And I think there was one of the calculations that I've read, like thousands of hours on a daily basis gets wasted on people just moving from one place to another just trying to get water to drink. Where me and you, alhamdulillah, thanks to Allah, we get to enjoy water from the pipe, clean, drinkable, healthy, and without even thinking where it came from and how it got to be here. That's a ni'mah from Allah that requires us to be thankful of. So when we look at other fellow human beings who have to travel kilometers, tens of kilometers, just to get a bucket of water so they could drink, not even to wash, not even to bathe, that's a problem. So we need to chip in. So the month of Ramadan, when you feel the thirst, think of those people who die out of thirst on a daily basis. Think of this 200 or 800 children who die daily because of thirst. Think of the millions of people who are who do not have access to clean water. So your charity, your sadaqah, goes a long way into helping these people. And like I said, Now you don't have to go dig a well yourself, like Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi used to do himself. You don't have to start, a filtration system on the sea. No, you don't have to do that. All you have to do is go online and chip in, pay a charity that helps get clean, drinkable water to people who are in need, be it in war-torn countries like Yemen, like Syria, or in countries that are just simply don't have any access to water, like in Africa. There are many organizations that are doing these things. All you need to do is put in your effort. So, hunger and thirst, two elements of the month of Ramadan, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants me to stop indulging in. At the same time, He wants me not only to feel the pain, but to think of those millions of people around the world who do not have access to food and do not have access to water. So don't just say, well, I got thirsty, I got hungry, Allah will get me into heaven. No, you need to do more than that. Inshallah, we'll continue this topic in episodes to come. So until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين.
This is Saudi Arabia, where women have recently been allowed to drive cars. As part of the Crown Prince's social reforms, or sweeping social reforms, as it's usually referred to inside the kingdom. Yet the radius of these reforms has been exaggerated. The shocking case of Abdulrahman Al-Sadan, a 37-year-old aid worker with the Red Crescent, proves that the reforms in Saudi society hardly exceed window dressing. As a political satirist, Abdulrahman Al-Sadan would use a popular parody account to mock the Saudi government for a couple of years. Little did he know that Riyadh had already hired some agents inside Twitter to infiltrate into Saudi accounts. In 2018, Al-Sadan was identified and arrested and stood trial. Now he has been sentenced to 20 years in prison plus 20 years more of travel ban.
I think that that what has happened reflects the insecurity of the regime, not insecurity from